Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 18th, 2005. This session is Environmental Research on the Great Lakes, presented by climatologist Brent Lofgren in the Fireside Room. This is disc number 2005-05.
My name is Brent Lofgren. I work for the Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, part of National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and a large part of the presentation today will be about that institution, and then I'll give you an overview of our institution, and then I sent out a general call to a bunch of my colleagues to ask them to provide material for this particular presentation, and a few of them responded, so I'll be showing you some of the things that they're doing. And the title that I have here is Grab Bag of Environmental Research on the North American Great Lakes. And the title that shows up on the schedule doesn't say North American Great Lakes, it just says Great Lakes. Now there are a lot of people like to talk about other sets of Great Lakes. There are the Great Lakes of Africa, Victoria, Tanganyika, and Malawi, or Nyasa, they go by different names. Then there are the Asian Great Lakes of Baikal and Balkhash, Baikal being the deepest lake in the world, and even saying the North American Great Lakes, usually we like to call them the Laurentian Great Lakes because they're in the drainage basin of the St. Lawrence River. Other people will refer to the Canadian Great Lakes. The southern Canadian Great Lakes would be Winnipeg and Winnipegosis, and the northwestern Canadian Great Lakes include Great Bear Lake and Great Slave Lake. So different people refer to different places as the Great Lakes. Anyway, here's the beginning of the overview of our institution. Our logo is in the middle there, Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, located in Ann Arbor, Michigan, as our headquarters. We'll look at some of the facilities a little later on. On the organizational chart, the next echelon up is not shown here, the Office of Oceanic and Atmospheric Research. This is the research arm of NOAA and includes several laboratories scattered around the country. The largest concentration of them are in Boulder, Colorado. Now, some of you who are from Seattle might know of the Pacific Marine and Ecosystems Laboratory, I think it is, PMEL, located in Seattle. And there are actually some other parts of NOAA that fall under different umbrellas, also located in Seattle. On the left is the logo of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which one of the parts of that that most people are most familiar with is the National Weather Service, which does operational weather forecasting. Our office does not do anything operationally, but simply does research. And on the right is the parent organization of NOAA, which is the U.S. Department of Commerce. And next rung up is you-know-who. This is the mission statement of GLURL, and one thing you might notice is the mission statement includes both the Great Lakes and marine coastal environments. We do have some research that's going on in the Gulf of Mexico is sort of one prime example, and near Florida in some cases. I really won't be talking about any of that activity today. What do? We do our own research. We provide leadership for research projects. One of the ways in which we're a little different from university research is that a lot of our work is base funded by Congress. What this means is that whereas university researchers generally get grants which have a finite lifetime, at most 5 years, our organization has the capability of doing much longer term research. And then long-term monitoring is another special capability that we have as a result of that. Technology development, information synthesis and assessment, outreach and education is what I'm doing right now. Okay, here are some facts about our lab. This is a picture of our main location, and this building has been located there since 1987. This photograph probably dates to about then. And those trees in the foreground have been replaced because of emerald ash borer. Anyway, this is the main facility in Ann Arbor. The lab was established in 1974 at a different location. 55 permanent staff, 18 SILR, which is the Cooperative Institute for Limnology and Ecosystems Research. It's a big mouthful, but that's the liaison organization that works between us and the University of Michigan to bring in sort of more temporary employees for specialized projects. And 15 other really covers a wide variety of people. Current annual budget is $8.7 million. A little bit about our main facility. It was built in 1987, 25,500 square feet, and we have a wide variety of features there. Here's our Lake Michigan field station, which is kind of interesting. When we first acquired it in 1990, it was kind of a ramshackle building or complex of buildings. The one you really see there is the main building, but there are a couple of smaller buildings there. It used to be a Coast Guard base in Muskegon, which is on the western part of the Lower Peninsula, right on Lake Michigan. 6 full-time staff are located there. Here's another view of it. This is for anyone who might be familiar with Muskegon. This is a little ways outside of the city of Muskegon. The main harbor activity occurs in a lake which is inland from this channel. So this is located right next to Lake Michigan itself. And there's just this little channel through which all the commercial vessels go. It's handy for us because it's right next to Lake Michigan itself. And here are a couple of our research vessels. This is the old one called the Shenahan, built in 1953. And it has a biodiesel engine on it. This is the Laurentian, which is somewhat newer, a little bit larger. And one thing you might notice on that smokestack is the yellow letter M. That's who it actually belongs to, is the University of Michigan. It's on long-term lease to Gloral. One of the main thrusts, basically what we call the umbrella for all of the research activity that occurs at Gloral, is ecosystem forecasting, and it's broken down into these four pieces: ecological prediction, aquatic invasive species, physical environment prediction, and environmental observing systems. So here are some of the goals under ecological prediction. Better understand eutrophication, which means hyperactivity of the biological system, which can lead to depleted oxygen in water. Toxic contaminants, aquatic invasive species proliferation, habitat modification, and climatic variation. A Here's just a little intro to the aquatic invasive species. I'll be talking in a little more detail about this later on, but we have a designated center that is dedicated to study of this, and that center has a few personnel that are specified as being part of that. Physical environment prediction, some of the things we look at are ice and lake levels, erosion, that sort of thing. Environmental observing systems, part of the operation is strictly to develop instruments and systems to deploy those instruments onto the lakes in order to be gathering data over the long term. Some of the current issues, and these are not all of them, lake water levels. We're looking at long-term climate change effects, which really is my part of my third talk in the series. I will probably be coming back around on Wednesday. Invasive species, no ballast on board, which is kind of the last bastion of bringing in invasive species, and the disappearance of Diaparia, which is a very small crustacean that formerly was very abundant in the Great Lakes but has largely disappeared, and some of our people are working on the reason for that. I don't really have a whole lot of other details on the Diaparia. So we're looking at lake water levels, and this is a picture in northern lower Michigan on the Lake Michigan shore of just this very wide beach due to low lake levels. And some of the techniques we use are computer-based models to make predictions over seasonal timescales. And some of the other things we're looking at are effects due to global warming that will happen over longer timescales. More on invasive species, and really I'm going to be talking more about this in connection with a particular researcher coming up. But at the top you see this Cercopagus and Bithotrephes, which are a couple of very small invasive species, and there's also the zebra mussels and the round goby. No ballast on board, actually, I'm going to be talking about later. Part of the spread of invasive species was due to exchanging ballast from ships within the Great Lakes, and that has been prohibited, but a few of the species still slip through. And these are some of the basics on the disappearance of Diaparia. May affect food webs and therefore many other species, ultimately fish production. So this is a quick profile on one of our researchers. This is Tom Crowley, and his area of expertise is on water resources within the Laurentian Great Lakes Basin, and he's worked up some more advanced models on runoff prediction. And the pieces of the system that he really uses are external to his model as input are insolation, which means the amount of sunlight that comes in, precipitation and temperature, and then he breaks that, the precipitation down into snow and rain. And then there are a number of storage reservoirs of this water that are active. One is the snowpack during the winter. Then he's divided soil moisture into upper soil zone and lower soil zone, and both of those interact with plants. so that the plants can draw from that and use those for their transpiration, which transfers some of that water back into the atmosphere. The groundwater soil zone is considered to be inaccessible by plants, but it may actually surface at some points, and he does have an arrow for transpiration there, but mostly it's inactive as far as exchanging water with the atmosphere. But water does flow underwater through that groundwater zone and into surface waters, rivers, streams, lakes, and it goes into that surface storage reservoir. And he also counts there as being some evaporation from that. And each of these reservoirs will have a certain characteristic storage time associated with it, so that the water will be stored there for a certain amount of time, and there's a delay time between when it enters the system as snow or rain and when it eventually comes out of the system as basin outflow. So there's sort of a smoothing mechanism that goes through this whole system. And this goes into a little bit more detail on the equations that he uses in there. Then he's divided this runoff basin into a grid, and for each of those little grid boxes, there's associated that whole system from the last couple of slides. Each of those five water reservoirs. So once that runoff occurs in each of those grid boxes, he's used the land elevation data to determine which direction it's going to run off, and then come up with this flow network. So each of those grid boxes flows into another one. And in the upper left, you see the elevation in this. And this is actually one corner of the runoff basin that we show on the next one. This is the Maumee River Basin, which has its mouth into Lake Erie right at Toledo, Ohio. And some of the northern, it's mostly in Ohio, some of the northern extreme is in Michigan, and some of the western extreme is in Indiana. And he's actually calibrated these parameters to get the best match between the modeled runoff and the observed runoff. So upper soil zone permeability, lower soil zone permeability, upper soil zone capacity, and then I guess the last one, square root of slope, is taken directly from the elevation data. So this is what he does for spatial hydrology. On the left, it's showing supply, which is basically the precipitation input. And going from top to bottom is time. He's actually looking at a case in 1950, and at the top is April 30th, second row is May 1st, and then May 2nd at the bottom. So you've got a little bit of a time progression. At the left is the amount of precipitation that's coming in. Next is infiltration, how much of that is going down into the upper soil zone. And then the amount of water that's being stored at the surface, then how much evaporation is going on. Now that one is actually increasing with time. You've got a little bit more storage, a little bit more water stored up, so that it's available for evaporation. And I'd expect another condition there is that some of the clouds are going away relative to when it's precipitating. So you've got more solar energy available to create that precipitation. Finally is outflow. And this is kind of one of the interesting things. The one on the top has a larger amount of outflow in those tiny little tributaries to the Maumee River. And then as you progress down, it becomes less and less in those smaller tributaries and just goes to those main stems of a few tributaries with time. So one of the reasons why we're working on this, the larger purpose of this is to find out how much runoff we might expect to happen in the Maumee Basin as this example, and a number of other drainage basins throughout the Great Lakes as a whole, in order to see how big of a load of chemicals you might expect to come into the lake. And some of those chemicals are contaminants and others are nutrients. And actually, in this case, I think we're concentrating more on the nutrients because those can lead to algae blooms in some of the nearshore areas. And a couple of these others, I'll just skip over this one. A couple of these others will deal a little bit more with the algae blooms. Okay, this is David Schwab, and his specialty is the circulation of lake water. And he was looking at a particular event that happened just a little over a year ago, where there was an extreme rain event in the area of Milwaukee, and the sewers overflowed. So some raw sewage ended up in Lake Michigan right next to Milwaukee, and that is basically food for bacteria and algae. So here's a long-term record of Milwaukee River discharges, and another peak is shown there in 1993. That was kind of another infamous event. There's a sewage overflow in Milwaukee at that time, and very similar kind of thing happened. There was a microcystis bloom, which is an algae that lets out toxin. And because of that, you have to be careful about swimming there.
Is this like in Lake Michigan you're talking about?
Yeah, this is in Lake Michigan. Okay. So you got this headline from Chicagoist, I guess. And yeah, Kerry found the key phrase in here and is laughing at it, where it says they think that this poisonous algae came from Milwaukee. So it says at the end of the first paragraph, officials blame the cheeseheads.
Was that the summer so many of the beaches were closed? I'll bet.
You know, beaches have closed every once in a while, but this is last year.
Last year.
So they got E. coli in the waters off of Chicago, and Chicago officials did want to blame the cheeseheads. But anyway, Dr. Schwab went back and tried to assess whether that's really possible. And I forgot I had this in here and I didn't connect it properly to the animation. I didn't insert the animation properly into my PowerPoint presentation here, but the bottom line of this is that in a time series, due to a numerical model of the Lake Michigan circulation, the possible distribution of E. coli with a source in Milwaukee never reaches Chicago within this time frame.
Were the beaches in Chicago contaminated E. coli, or just they thought they were?
They were contaminated, and they wanted to blame it on Milwaukee, okay. But I think they had to look a little closer to to lay the blame, yeah.
Interesting.
Okay, the next person I wanted to profile was David Rako, and he's posing in front of a ultraviolet detector that he uses for probing some of the invasive species. And I sort of thought about cropping off this picture, but I wanted to include that yellow thing at the top, which is actually an emergency shower in case you get a chemical spill on yourself. So his specialty is invasive species, and sorry about the little problem with color scheme here, but invasive species in the Laurentian Great Lakes are not such a new thing, but they keep increasing with time. You can see that the timeline here starts at 1830 on the left side and goes up to 2000. The number of species has just been increasing over that amount of time. And this is called the historical Great Lakes food web. It at the base of it are phytoplankton, which means very small plants. Algae are included in this classification. Those are consumed by zooplankton, which in turn are consumed by benthos, which is really a catch-all phrase. That means anything that lives at the bottom of the lake. Benthos just means bottom. So there are some crustaceans that live down there and a few other things. And then small fish in the next layer. And then in this illustration, lake trout is used as the top predator. Now here's how it's altered with the addition of several invasive species. And he's actually illustrated zooplankton next to the bottom as being invasive, because a lot of them are. There were previously native zooplankton, but they've been displaced by a lot of invasive zooplankton, such as those commonly known as spiny water flea, the Bithotrephes and Cercopagus. Oh, I guess, yeah, he's actually shown that as the next level above. And then zebra mussel above that, which is one of the most famous types of invaders. And then there are several species of fish that are also are invasive. Now this is getting back to the no ballast on board issue. Historically, the main way that invasive species in the Great Lakes got there was that ships would go across the Atlantic, and they would go into the Black Sea. A lot of the invaders are from the Black Sea. They'd go there, they'd fill up their ballast tanks, and then come across the Atlantic into the Great Lakes, and then empty their ballast tanks in order to take on a cargo. Now that has been outlawed, and they are required to dump all of their ballast in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and pull on fresh ballast there, which is salt water and basically contains nothing that will be capable of living in the Great Lakes. So that has solved the main problem, but you're sort of left with the problem of the ships that say they have no ballast on board, But in fact, there's a certain amount of residual water stuck in those ballast tanks that you just can't get out, and there might be a few critters living in there. So this cross section gives a little bit of an illustration of how there are nooks and crannies within those ballast tanks that basically are the support structure for the ship, and just how tough it is to flush all that water out of there. So here are a few of the invasive species. On the upper left is the sea lamprey, which is a, something that sucks the blood out of another one, a parasite. That's the word I was looking for. And it hooks onto adult fish and just stays stuck to them. And that actually does originate as a seawater creature. The alewife in the lower left is a small fish that has taken up a niche in the Great Lakes ecosystem. And then on the bottom right is the zebra mussel. And this picture is actually showing a colony of a whole bunch of zebra mussels just kind of moved onto the shell of a native mollusk. And for those who have not seen a zebra mussel, it's a very small thing. It's about the size of a fingernail on my pinky. But they live by the millions in all parts of the Great Lakes these days. And they also have a cousin called the quagga mussel, which is another invasive species that's almost the same thing, a little bit larger, and they occupy the same ecological niche. Another piece that was passed on to me by David Greco, and I decided to try to find a picture of this guy because he is a Lutheran, Tom Bridgman, and he's looked at some of these harmful algal blooms in the region of Toledo, western Lake Erie, and he actually took this sample, just dipped the cup into the lake, wow, and pulled this up, and this is Microcystis, and it's highly toxic. Don't drink that water right there, unless you want to die quickly. Now this part is actually getting a little bit away from the Great Lakes itself, but I included Tony England because he's a Lutheran also, and goes to my church, and he is with the, he's in a couple of departments. He's in the Department of Atmospheric, Oceanic, and Space Sciences at University of Michigan, and also in mechanical engineering. And I'll tell you a little bit later, a little more about that kind of older picture on the right. This is one of the studies that he has carried out, looking at Columbia Glacier in Alaska, and doing some radar sounding to try to measure how stable it is and see whether they can come up with predictions on how stable that glacier is and how much of it will calve from that glacier and start drifting out to sea. So here are some of the results that they got from that investigation. And then Tony was also an astronaut going back a ways, and he went up on the shuttle on the mission called Space Lab 2 in 1985. And apparently his main mission on this shuttle launch was to investigate photograph and look at the electromagnetic fields associated with auroras. So they went up into space on the shuttle like this. And there he is inside the shuttle. Can't really see much out the window, so you can't really tell just where he is. So here's an aurora as seen in Fairbanks, and actually I think it may be this very same photograph. One of the interesting things about aurora was that I once saw a pair of photographs, one taken in Alaska and one taken in southern Chile, South America, and they're mirror images of each other.
Oh, wow.
The
Rorqual strings.
Yeah. Yeah, the auroral activity is basically carried along these magnetic field lines of the Earth, and so the same thing is happening in both hemispheres in mirror image. But this is a view from the ground of the aurora, and the next photograph is taken from out in space. So you get maybe more of a impression of the vertical extent of the aurora by looking at it this way. And that's the end of my presentation for today.
The muscles seem like they were talking about it in the paper on the ships were causing so much problem. Have they ever resolved that? That was bad.
Well, they've gone a long way toward preventing them from coming in, but those zebra muscles really are already there, and there's very little way of getting rid of them once the genie's out of the bottle.
They've been trying to get rid of them, or they can't find a way to get rid of them.
They really can't find a way to get rid of them because, for instance, where I live, I've done just a little bit of swimming in the Huron River, which is a tributary to Lake Erie, and just these little spots near shore are completely covered with them.
No kidding.
Oh yeah, they're in an area as big as this chair may be covered with thousands of zebra mussels, and some of those that instrument. Development that I was showing from our lab, one of the big problems they have, they used to use current meters that would just have a rotor on them, and it's a simple way of measuring current, just measure how fast that rotor is going around. They can't do that anymore because there are so many zebra mussels that grow on that instrument that it just clogs it up very quickly. And they can't use it. So now they have to use Doppler acoustical current meters, which have no moving parts. Yeah.
So the sea lampreys are able to auto-regulate like really well? It doesn't use, they're obviously originally in salt water.
Oh, I guess so. I really don't know the details.
Because otherwise they just explode.
Yeah, right.
Earth. Yeah.
Is there a way of shutting off those ballast tanks so they don't have to sloshing around with water when they get in, or do they have to open them up? And
when they have no ballast on board, basically all they're going to do is fill them up, but it seems there's always a little bit of leakage as they're filling them up. So, I guess I didn't really talk about some of the remedies they have. They've been trying a bunch of different chemicals to kill anything living in those ballast tanks, but yet not be toxic to the environment because they're going to end up getting out into the environment at some point.
Now, the Great Lakes are shrinking, is the idea, right?
Over the last several years, they've had water levels drop by a few feet. Most of that drop occurred during 1998 through 2000, and it stabilized after that, and it's risen just a little bit since then. If you come back on Wednesday, I don't know if you'll still be around. Yeah, that's when I talk about global warming, and there's a debate on which way the Great Lakes might go as a result of global warming.
Okay, really?
Yeah, and part of that debate is internally within myself.
You have to decide.
A large part of that debate, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there history of fluctuation on lake levels going back centuries? This is a repeat of, or is this unique?
The people who kind of have come up with a paradigm for this say there's a 30-year cycle, which is based on observational records, going back a little over 100 years.
Cool.
And then they also claim there's about 180-year cycle, which they've arrived at by using methods of measuring paleo lake levels, which involves digging into the sand dunes on the shores and finding where there were ancient wetlands, looking for carbon in there and carbon-14 dating it, and then finding what the level is. And that is good for giving you an answer for what was the maximum lake level between some set of dates around the time when it's indicated by carbon-14 dating. So they've been able to do a bunch of reconstructions of that, and they claim that there's also a 180-year cycle. Now, what is causing either of those cycles, I don't think anyone has determined.
It's amazing. Well, it certainly is interesting, isn't
it? Any more questions?
I have one more question. I was kind of surprised. I didn't realize NOAA was under the Department of Commerce.
Right.
And I was a little curious, in a lot of the stuff here I could see that might have some commercial reasons why you'd be looking at it, but a lot of it doesn't. It doesn't seem to me. And I wondered how much of your funding came directly because of commercial interests or because, you know, of stuff that was just interest of pure science or of, just the variations that you've been talking about.
There's kind of a evolution within our organization from ever since its inception in 1970, NOAA has been part of the Department of Commerce. Over the years, though, it's turned away somewhat from the basic science toward more applied science, and a lot of the research that you see here is driven by whatever commercial interests are out there, asking government agencies to see what they can find out about a particular problem. So the invasive species started out by they identified a problem with these invasive species and then started putting in regulations for that, seeing how well they worked or didn't work, and then it has an impact on these shippers because they have to comply with the regulations, so they have an interest in this, and a lot of that research requires the cooperation of shippers because people go onto their ships and sample inside their ballast tanks.
What about global warming issues when you have an economic system that does sort of doesn't want to deal with the issues or contributors to global warming? Do you find that either the research that you've done or the payment for research is either influenced or directed by the current administration in terms of economic outcome?
Yeah. One example I'd like to use is again going back to the shippers, and I'll go over this a little bit more on Wednesday, but when we're looking at global warming influences on lake levels, that's also of interest to shippers. They want to know how big of a draft they can have going through the Detroit River, for example. So they have an interest in that, and if the draft is going to be more shallow, that means they can't put as much goods on their ship. They have to have a lighter load. Yeah, as far as we do have to interact with Great Lakes area industries, and a lot of them are major greenhouse gas emitters. And another local interest is the auto industry.
Do you find yourself compromised at all?
I wouldn't say that I find myself compromised when I stay within the scientific arena. And my job really isn't that much to be an advocate for a particular means of mitigating climate change. So I find myself free to say that climate change, global warming is a real thing, there certainly does remain more controversy in the upper echelons of government about how to deal with that.
They just haven't figured out the way they can profit from it the most. That's what they're really working on. It's kind of off topic, but did you see that article in, I think it was in the Mars Scientific American, that they posed that we avoided an ice age due to human activities starting about 8,000 years ago?
No, I didn't see that.
What was that?
Well, they... about 8,000 years ago, humans started clearing land for agriculture and that sort of thing. And if you look at the temperatures over the last 100,000 years, you find these 12,000 year cycles, and it should have started getting colder, but it didn't. The temperature started going up about 8,000 years ago, and then there was another increase in temperatures about 5,000 years ago, and that's when they started doing large scale growing rice. And the vegetation that lays in the bottom of the rice paddies and dies produces methane, which is a greenhouse gas. And so there are basically...
Which issue was that in?
I think it was March.
Oh, that's interesting.
American March 2005.
But is that the constant debate about whether humans have contributed to this? We'll learn about that on Wednesday.
Yeah, well, humans have been contributing, at least in local ways, to climate for a long time.
There isn't really any debate about it. There's the people who recognize the facts and the people who, for one reason or another, choose to ignore
them.
That's what
I was wondering.
There really isn't any debate.
Whether the contribution is... There's no debate about global warming, probably, but is there a debate about the contribution or not, or is it just whoever wants to look at the science or not?
No, there isn't any debate about the contribution of humans. Yet you have people who are profiting from it. Smoking doesn't cause cancer.
There are still a few holdouts to the general idea of global warming, and those among them who are scientists, basically what they're saying is, just trying to cite limited number of reasons why it might not be as great as the others are saying. for instance, some of them are saying the increase in water vapor, which compounds the effect of the increase in carbon dioxide, will not extend as high in the atmosphere as most of the models are claiming. So that would lead to a lesser amount of warming. And they're looking in particular at the places where both the historical record up to this point and the future model projections show the most warming, which is your part of the world, northwestern Canada and Alaska and Siberia.
And that's where they're getting it now.
Getting
most warming.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
In the places where the models say that they're most warming.
Well, the Columbia Glacier is interesting because, you know, it went by that, you know, years ago, and there's this 500-foot wall of ice, and I hadn't seen it for 15 years or so, and I couldn't believe it when I went back there and saw this huge piece of nature that now was, you know, gone. It was just slush in the bay, then it would all disappear, and I didn't think something that massive in that period of time could change so much.
Yeah. Yeah, pictures, maybe they're up in the Portland Museum, but there's pictures of the glaciers in this area, you know, 80 or 100 years ago, and pictures of them now. And there's a whole lot less of them than there used to be.
But somebody argued that even though that we talk about glaciers receding and stuff, that a lot of them are growing, but is that because that they're actually the glaciers growing, or are they just sliding down the mountains faster?
I heard something recently about part of the Antarctic ice sheet that is actually increasing in thickness. And the reason given for that, I think, you know, this remains somewhat speculative, but in those really cold places, warming actually leads to an increased amount of snowfall.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so that that may happen in Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be more surprised about places where it's kind of more of a terrestrial mountain glacier at high altitudes in other parts of the world.
Well, thank you. That was real interesting.
All right.
Appreciate it.
All right. Come back on Monday. I'm not sure yet what time that's going to be.
Okay.
Just working up that schedule right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, I'll be leaving tomorrow, so I'll have to miss the rest.
Your name is?
Jim Allen.
Jim? All right. I'm Brent.
Good to meet you.
You work in electrical engineering? What? Oh, I think that said electrical engineering. Bluegrass Festival.
I don't know. I do electronic engineering, though.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
So maybe cool. Maybe you're reading my aura or something.
Yeah. Okay. Good to meet you, Jim.